I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Gun violence, all too common in America. Losing a loved one because of it can lead to an unforgiving anger in family members on both ends of the gun. Today, how a shooting took the life of one man's son and spurred an unlikely friendship with the shooter's grandfather, bonded through grief. The men are working together to spare others from a similar tragedy. Then, a family's journey was meant to offer a better life in America. But for the family of NPR correspondent Arthi Shahani, that dream took an unexpected and drastic turn. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. For the next 25 minutes or so, you will forgive me if I get a little emotional, and you should prepare for the same. The story of these two men, how they came to their life's work, is remarkable and crucial to our time. Azeem Kamis's only son, Tariq, was shot and killed by Tony Hicks, just 14 years old at the time, and the grandson of Ples, Felix. Yet Azeem and Ples are with me right now, friends, brothers, they would say, since the murder back in 1995. Those two gentlemen join me from the Bill Corkery Production Studios in San Diego. Gentlemen, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Azeem, I want to start with you. And would you please tell me about the night in San Diego when you heard your son was murdered?
Yes, he was a good kid. He was a student at San Diego University, SDSU, San Diego State University, and was an art student, good writer, great photographer, inspired someday to work for National Geographic. His hero was Gandhi, a man of peace, and he worked on Fridays and Saturdays as a pizza delivery man. And he was lured to a bogus address by a youth gang in the North Park, which is not far from where he went to school. And they gave the right apartment building with the wrong apartment number. And it was his turn to make the delivery. So he got to the site of the crime and knocked on many doors trying to find out who'd ordered the pizzas. Of course, nobody had. He came back to the car, put the pizzas in the trunk of his car, climbed into the driver's side seat. And as he was about to back his car from the driveway of the apartment building, he was accosted by four youth gang members. Three of them were 14, and the leader of the gang was an 18-year-old who handed a 9mm handgun to a 14-year-old and gave the order, "Bust him bones." And the 14-year-old fired one round, which came through the driver's side window, entered my son's body under the left shoulder blade. The bullet traveled across the upper part of his chest and actually exited from his right armpit, but it was fatal. And Tariq died a couple of minutes later, drowning in his own blood over a lousy pizza at the age of 20.
Plus,
so needless to say, needless to say, it brought my life to a crashing halt. I don't know what's more complicated for a parent to lose a child. I went through all the emotions you'd expect a parent to go through. Even at one point, I was suicidal, and. But sometimes, you know, in deep trauma, there is a spark of clarity. I practice as a Sufi Muslim. I used to meditate an hour a day. Now my practice is 2 hours a day. And I think that my spiritual foundation kind of got me through this tragedy, because the spark of clarity that I had in this tragedy is I saw that there were victims at both ends of the gun. that the enemy was not the 14-year-old that killed my son, but rather the societal peer pressure that forced many young men, especially young men of color, to fall to the crack and choose lives of gangs and crimes and drugs and alcohol and weapons. And that was the real enemy. So to honor my son 9 months after he passed away, I founded the Tariq Khamisa Foundation with the mission to stop kids from killing kids. And our initial mandate was to essentially save lives of children and then empower them with the right choices so they don't fall through the crack. And our third mandate was to teach the principles of nonviolence, of empathy, of accountability, of compassion, of forgiveness, of peace building. And soon after I founded the foundation, I reached out to Ples, which was Tony's grandfather, with the attitude, we both lost a child. I'm not here screaming revenge or retribution because your grandson killed my son. Rather, I'm here in the spirit of compassion and forgiveness. It's because what I really see here is we both lost a son. I lost my son. He's dead. He's gone forever. And Ples lost his grandson, who was like a son, lived with them, to the adult criminal justice system. And my attitude was, you know, I can't bring Tariq back from the dead, and there's nothing you can do to get Tony out of prison, but we can save other parents and grandparents from suffering what you and I have gone through. And as you see, 24 years later, we're still together.
I want to talk about the foundation's work, why you're going to be in Kansas City, but plus I want to go to you. Bones was the gang name for your grandson. And I'd like you to tell me about what you remember about that night and the events that led up to it.
Tony was born to my 14-year-old daughter. Tony never had a relationship with his teenage father. That created a lot of anger with Tony because he was pretty much as a young child dependent on my mom to assist with his raising. Of course, I assisted with his raising. And when he came to live with me in San Diego, I understood he was very angry because he really wanted to be with his mother and certainly wanted to be a part of what he considered to be a healthy nuclear family. But Tony had experienced a lot of trauma before he came to live with me. Shortly before he came to live with me, he experienced the aftermath of the murder of one of his favorite cousins at the hands of rival gang members up in Los Angeles. That added to his anger and his distress. So with his anger, with his emotional upset, trying to make a transition to living with me in San Diego had to be extremely challenging for Tony, I'm sure. And certainly on this particular evening, Tony had been having challenges the week before in school, not being attentive, missing classes, taking off from school, having the kind of behavior that most children have when they have lots of trauma, lots of confusion, lots of conflict going on, and lots of stress that's unresolved in a way that kids are not capable of correcting or otherwise satisfying to a healthy level. This particular day, let me go back the night before. Tony had been out of school, had trouble at school, so the night before, he and I had what we call just a meeting. Came in my room, I had 2 pieces of fruit, I gave him a piece of fruit. I explained to him, I said, look, you're having trouble in school, you're not paying attention, things are going bad for you in school, tell me what's going on with you, how are you doing? And Tony looked me right in the face, he said, Daddy, I'm the kind of person that if I think I can get away with it, I'll do anything. And I saw right there in his face and his eyes, he was very serious. And I said to him from the heart, I said, son, look, please understand what I tell you. Sometime soon, somebody's going to offer you a loaded handgun and tell you to shoot somebody. What are you going to do? He said, Daddy, I would never do that. I would never do that. I said, that's what you tell me now. But what are you going to tell those people out there at the point of decision that you have to make? You're going to be confronted. You have to make a decision. And he said, I would never do that. Surely enough, the very next day, that day, Tony ran away from home. He went to be with people he thought were his friends, 2 14-year-old boys he had known since 4th grade, and an 18-year-old he didn't know at all. and in their presence that evening, the 18-year-old understood that Tony was a runaway and offered him alcohol and drugs, and he took them, thinking it would make him feel better and feel carefree. But then the 18-year-old invited Tony to a robbery of a pizza delivery man with his two 14-year-old friends, who had known the 18-year-old previously and had been doing crimes with the 18-year-old, and had certainly welcomed Tony out of his household into their new group and gang, as they called themselves, to do crimes with them. And this was Tony's first opportunity to actually prove himself as a new gang member. So at the point of Tariq Kamisa's arrival to do his work, do his job, to work his way and support himself through college, he was ambushed and shot to death by my 14-year-old grandson. Something that's unspeakable, unbelievable. And we always are focused on the fact that Tony, of course, having committed that crime, was the first kid at the age of 14 to be tried as an adult in the state of California. So through the process, of course, Tony was adjudicated and was sentenced to 25 years to life. But before he did that, he made a very compelling and certainly very serious and heartfelt apology to the Kamisa family for the murder of Tariq, and he promised to be a better person, and then he was sentenced to 25 years to life.
Plus, Azeem has talked about how he's forgiven Tony, but I'm wondering if you had to forgive Tony and what that journey was like.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that as a two-tour Vietnam veteran serving the United States Army, I have had to do a lot of work in my life with respect to forgiving myself for that journey in order to work on my own health and well-being. So for me as a practitioner of meditation and certainly working on my own mental social stability, it was not hard at all for me because I love my daughter, I love Tony. It was not a struggle for me to forgive Tony because I do understand and accept the fact that Tony was a kid that grew up with lots of challenges, and certainly kids make mistakes, big ones, little ones, horrific ones. But Tony was never beyond the love, and he was never outside of my love, and I forgave him. And from that point on, I understood that Tony required the support of his family in a loving, non-judgmental way. So I never judged Tony. I understood the kid made a horrible mistake, and that mistake would be with him for the rest of his life. However, the point that was really significant was the forgiveness that Azeem Kamisa extended to Tony and to my family. That forgiveness opened the door for a whole new healthy perspective about dealing with this tragedy in a way that made sense, that felt good, and inspired for more, better, and more constructive behavior on my part, and to support Tony along his path in prison.
Has he made parole yet? Because he was up for parole.
Tony was successfully paroled. And I have to say this, he was successfully paroled because Azeem Kamisa, his daughter Tazreen Kamisa, were present at Tony's parole hearing and spoke from their hearts and their dedicated understanding that Tony would be better served and our community and society would be better served if Tony was paroled. And I am certain that based on their recommendation and their heartfelt presentation to the parole board that Tony was successfully granted parole. And Tony was released this past April and assigned to a transitional living facility where he has been since he was released. And I have to say that, again, the love and support of the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, the Kamisa family, and certainly my family has helped Tony successfully transition. Now he's living at home with me. He's only been there for a very short time, and he's looking forward to learning. He's looking forward to continuing his education. He really looks forward to being a supporter of the Tariq Kamisa Foundation and to assist us with the work that we do. And Tony's testimony to children will be compelling because it will come from the authentic voice of a person who committed a crime, a horrific crime, at 14 years old. spent 24-plus years in adult prison to come out with the understanding that he has been forgiven, but he has been and also will be held accountable to focus his life in a positive, constructive way as a contributing citizen of our society. And he wants to be a plumber. He wants to be a guy that goes in and helps people solve their plumbing problems and make a decent life doing that. So step by step, he's got lots of love and support in the community, both from his family as well as from a great foundation founded by Azeem Kamisa. And we're looking forward to Tony's making a contribution when he's ready and healthily situated to do that.
Congratulations, Pless. I'm so happy that he's home with you. Azeem, tell me about the Forgiveness Project and coming here to Kansas City and what you can do for just an awful gun violence problem in this community right now.
Yes, my condolences for your recent loss to the families of the slain people that was on the news just before we got on there. But as you know, even just in 2018, we've had 341 mass killings in our country, almost one a day. And it's gone to proportions. It's become an epidemic. And I think it's very important that we make sure that we reverse the trend. My own personal view is that we need to create, what we have created in the Tariq Kamisa Foundation is a safe school model. And that safe school model has four programs. The first one is a live assembly with Ples and me, where I share my story and he shares his story. And then, you know, I mean, the first time we did this, given like 1,000 presentations, I asked how many of you have lost family members as a result of violence, and two-thirds of the hands went up. I mean, I cried all the way home thinking, my God. We specialized from fifth to ninth grade. Tony joined a gang in sixth grade and took my son's life in eighth grade. And so there's a lot of guilt and shame and grief in the audience, and we process how do you take all of those negative emotions and react in a positive way, as I was able to. We then created a 10-week restorative practices curriculum. I have three different levels. The first one is for fifth and sixth graders. The second one is seventh and eighth. And the last one is for the ninth graders. And the third program is we create a peace club on campus, which essentially is a leadership program. We have 100 different titles of how do you become a leader that practices the principles of nonviolence, becomes engaged in the community, and becomes committed to peacemaking and peace building. And then the last program is a mentoring program. We have our own mentors that actually work on school campuses with the challenging kids. The first three programs go through the entire school, whereas the mentoring program is targeted to the kids that were like Tony, that were on a slippery slope, which are very easy to point out. And we've created an affordable solution. You know, it costs $11,500 to provide free public education in California. The incarceration rate is $148,000 a year per one inmate. And even after that, they produce an 84% recidivism rate. We can do our magic for $100 a kid a year. And we are now, besides teaching these important values of accountability, empathy, compassion, forgiveness, peace building, we're also cutting expulsions and suspensions by 70%. No one that goes through the safe school model is going to take a gun and kill. Just not possible. And that's where I think we need to, sure, I do agree that we do need responsible gun violence, gun regulation, and there's too many easy access to guns, and I think that the organization that's invited Ples and me are doing an amazing job, you know, Grandparents Against Gun Violence, and I really want to commend and acknowledge them. But at the same time, while we do need responsible gun regulation, and there's plenty of examples in England and Canada and other parts of Europe, it's not that complicated, and I think most of the Americans would welcome responsible gun regulation. I also think that we need to prevent, and TKF is in the prevention spot because we lose way too many kids on a daily basis. I mean, I think about Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 first graders, 5 and 6 years old, were gunned down in machine gun fire. I mean, they had a lot of living to do. So now we've been working in San Diego County for the 24 years to create a viable and affordable solution. We now have that. And we have our second site in Pennsylvania, in Newtown, Pennsylvania, and would love to bring that to Kansas City.
You can hear both of these gentlemen, their compelling story. Next week, they'll be in Kansas City. Heartland Coalition Against Gun Violence. It's the 6th annual community forum. It's Monday from 8:30 a.m. to 2:30 in the afternoon. It's at the KU Edwards Campus Best Conference Center, 126 in Quivira in Overland Park. You can get tickets through Grandparents Against Gun Violence website. Click on Community Forum Registration. Akeem Azim Kamisa and Ples Felix joining us from San Diego. Gentlemen, thank you for sharing your story. And I'm sure that you will be compelling and add to the conversation we have to have on gun violence here in Kansas City. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for having us.
Stay with us when we return, a journey from India to Rikers Island. I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm in for Steve Kraske for the next couple of days. Kraske off mic. That is the weekly newsletter from Steve Kraske and the Up to Date team. You can subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. There is exclusive content sent right to your inbox every Monday. Get it at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, cinema often informs our ideas of love and sex when prominent film critic says this can be a problem in our own relationships. Find out how. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. The next voice you will hear will be familiar. It's NPR correspondent Aarti Shahani, who you hear covering high tech and Silicon Valley. But that's not at all the reason she's here with me on Up to Date this morning. Aarti's here to talk about her memoir, Here We Are. Aarti, welcome to Kansas City and to Up to Date.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
The book is about journeys, your family's journey from India to America, your journey with your dad, and we all take that journey, mm-hmm. and his journey through the U.S. legal system and prison system. So let's start at the beginning. How and when did your family come to America?
Sure. My family came to the U.S. in 1981. My parents were originally from the Indian subcontinent, but were uprooted as children at the end of British colonialism. They ended up migrating to many countries, effectively stateless for their whole lives. My siblings and I were born in Morocco. And then we came to Queens, to New York. There's a funny thing to me about the immigrant journey, which is that, you know, people have the wherewithal to cross an entire ocean, and then they get exhausted, lose steam, and just live right by the airport. Right. And that's basically what my family did. That's what many families have done. So we came in 1981. We overstayed tourist visas. We were undocumented for a few years. But then we got our papers through a process that is now derided as chain migration. What's funny to me about the term is it's always been a positive term in my ears, because to me, each family member is a link in a chain sponsoring other family members and growing strong families in the U.S.
Right. You had relations here.
That's right. An aunt and an uncle who were U.S. citizens who'd sponsored us. And that's how we managed to get our own papers. And then we thought we were on the straight shot to the American dream, but that's not how it works.
What happened?
So, I mean, in a sense, we were doing really well for a narrow window of time. I kind of trace this journey in the book. One's life is a little bit like a puzzle. And if you stop to write a memoir, you basically have all these pieces and you put them together. What I saw was that for a few years, things were really solid. I became a scholarship kid at an incredibly fancy private school in Manhattan. In today's terms, it costs a Tesla a year to go to that school. Incredibly elite. I learned for the first word terms like country house. I had no idea what that was before getting to my school. And then I learned it was a home that is a second home, which I found completely astonishing because I grew up with my siblings and parents in a one-bedroom apartment where, like, literally we fought over closet space And I woke up more than once with a roach crawling on my bare leg. But, you know, I was kind of going into places I didn't even know existed. And my father opened up an electronics shop on the very same street where he used to shovel snow for $4 an hour. So he was on his path to the dream. Until that, his dad got arrested.
And what did he get arrested for?
Yeah, so according to New York State, he sold watches and calculators to the Cali drug cartel, a really notorious drug traffickers, incredibly well-known and covered in New York City in the 1990s when this was occurring. So my father was taken to Rikers Island, and it was Rikers Island, a jail by the airport, very well-known. And it was confusing to
us. Not just well-known, notorious.
Notorious. Incredibly notorious.
Right. I mean as prisons in America go, there are few that are more notorious than Rikers
Island.
Yeah,
there's been a great deal of coverage of the kinds of horrific things that happen at Rikers. Gang rapes against prisoners while guards look on, beatings. My father's first night at Rikers when he was being held there awaiting a court hearing, a man came up to him in the middle of the night and said, "Give me your wedding ring or I'm going to cut off your finger." And my father was actually, he started making a noise. He didn't want to give up his wedding ring because that was his connection to my mother. And that was, welcome intro to the system. When my father first got arrested, I was, and I think anyone who's ever had an arrested or incarcerated loved one will understand this, I was incredibly ashamed. Yeah. I felt like, oh my God, what has my father done? And I was a little kid who wanted to be a prosecutor. I've always thought a lot about justice. It's in my karma, my DNA, whatever. So I was really ashamed of Dad. But as his case wore on, at first in court, prosecutors made my father sound like a big-time drug trafficker in our family business, like a front for a cartel.
Right.
And I was confused.
And the sales they alleged was to launder money.
That's right. Correct.
That would have meant that he had to be selling thousands of watches and other things. Was that the case?
Well, yeah. So my father ran a wholesale electronics store. Exactly.
Store,
yeah. So you were selling thousands.
Yeah.
And making about, a 4% margin. So
right.
the name of the game was bulk sales.
Right.
And what was interesting to me is, my dad, he's somebody who's part of, he's since passed. My family is part of low-end globalization, which is most globalization, okay?
Yeah.
It's not the upper echelons. It's not the elite. It's working people. My father opened up a small shop, and pretty much did what all of his neighbors were doing. This is, by the way, a fact. I was able to verify this while writing the book. He was selling in bulk Casio watches and Sharp calculators to whoever would buy. Now, here's something that is interesting about the case is...
Which, by the way, that's capitalism. That's the American way.
Yeah.
There was nothing wrong with that.
I mean...
On its face and...
Yeah. Well, I would even say now as a business correspondent who's covered a lot of, leaders in, whether we're talking about Uber or Facebook, what I've observed is that business leaders are often cutting corners intentionally or unintentionally, but the ones with extreme wealth at most get slapped with a civil penalty. And the little guy gets slapped with criminal charges. That's how the justice system works.
And let me just stay with that just for a second.
Yeah.
So your dad's operation was in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you're how old at the time?
When he was arrested, I was 16.
16.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day the NYPD or the district attorney's office detectives come, put the cuffs on him, mm-hmm. take him.
Yeah, they take him as well as his little brother, my uncle, who were both running the store. And they tell them, hey, there were the official charges of money laundering and a 13-count indictment. And basically, and this is the interesting thing about the criminal justice system, think of it as a theater. And that's not to – listen, I believe in rule of law. I also believe in due process. They go hand in hand, okay? That first hearing is designed to make the defendant feel like, wow, the world and the odds are stacked against me, and there is like there is nothing I can do here. And the reason it's designed that way is because ultimately the system needs you to take a guilty plea quickly, because that's how it works. I mean, it's a plea bargaining system. So very few people go to trial, and that's because of what's called the trial penalty. If you exercise your right to trial and if you're convicted, you get a much, much stiffer sentence. So in my dad's case, we actually hired private attorneys. They said, Mr. Shahani, the prosecutor's offering 8 months. Now, first of all, if my father's store was a front for a cartel, why would prosecutors just offer 8 months? That seems like crazy small. But anyway, the defense attorney said, you can get 8 months or you can go to trial. You could face a decade, 15 years. What do you want to do, Mr. Shahani? And just to give you a sense of who my father was, he worked 7 days a week. He wore Velcro sneakers from Payless. He was not a rich man swimming in dough, able to take a gamble. So he did what everyone does. He pleaded. And unfortunately for us, we did not know this, both for my father and my uncle, those pleas that were supposed to be 8 month sentences ended up spiraling into a 14-year legal battle, because even though they were legal residents with green cards, lawful permanent residency, the federal government came in and began deportation proceedings as a surprise second punishment. And so I write about this in the book, and here we are, American dreams, American nightmares. I am pulling away from my voice as Silicon Valley correspondent. I call myself the Indian IT lady. That's how I joke about who I am on air. I'm pulling away from that voice to reflect on how did I get to this point? And there were so many twists and turns that are ugly and dark, but also hopeful. My family story, my memoir, is not just a front row seat into here's how the legal system really works. It's a journey of a daughter and a father to actually stay together in this country and do really resourceful and scrappy things to make it happen.
Talk to me about that resourcefulness and scrappiness.
Yeah.
And how that informs your reporting to this day, because I believe that there are events or series of events for every reporter that informs how they do their job forever. And I want to know how this informs yours.
I'll answer your question. What I'm immediately wondering is like, huh, what do you mean by that for your own life? Because you're speaking from a place of personal experience.
Well, when I'm on your talk show, you can.
There we go.
I'll be happy to answer that.
I won't deflect.
Because I've explored that within myself, because I think you have to so that you can do the job. But this cannot help but shape how you go about your job, I would think.
Deeply. I mean, the greatest training I've had in my life was fighting to keep my father in this country once the federal government began a deportation proceeding to delegalize him. Okay. I started on that campaign when I was 19 years old. I did not know I would be fighting it until I was 30 years old. So I pretty much grew up in the shadow of that case. I began fighting it by actually, I stopped going to college. I was at the University of Chicago. I stopped going to college and focused my entire attention on trying to assemble a legal team and political support, members of Congress, important people with letterhead, whether they were university professors or important nonprofit leaders or business leaders. I basically mounted a campaign to try to, and I'm going to use frank words here, and I do this in my book as well, in my memoir. I'm very candid about this. I was trying to exploit every tiny legal loophole I possibly could. And the reason for that is that our immigration system, the deportation courts, don't have any semblance of due process. It's not as though we have a system where we could go into court and dad could explain himself and my family members who are now U.S. citizens could say, hey, there's no need to deport dad. He served his time and he's sorry. A judge literally has no right to judge. It's an automatic process. Deportation's automatic. So when you have a system, a justice system without justice, all you're left with is politicking around the corners, which is what I did. So you asked me about journalistic training. Well, a deportation case and beat reporting are not that different to fight or to pursue. For my father's case, I had to map out who is every single actor in this system who can do something, who can give me a letter or who can make a call or who can grant something that will increase our power. In reporting, what are we doing? We're mapping. Who are the relevant actors? What is the information I can dig up from them? It's a process of search and discovery, the both.
We only have a couple of minutes, so I want to hear how this changed or enhanced your relationship with your dad.
Mm. This is the most important part of my memoir. What I'm sharing with people in Here We Are, and I really want the reader to take this in, is what my father and I went through to stay together in this country as a family with my brother and mother and sister was painful. Frankly, it destroyed his life. But the one silver lining in it is I actually got to know who my father was. When I was little, like a lot of us, my dad was a stranger. I didn't like him. I didn't know him. And once I decided to pay attention to this case that was ripping at him, we got to actually turn toward each other and see each other. I mean, this experience gave me a working definition of love. Okay, I don't know how you define it. I know how to define it. It is love is when you turn toward someone who is in pain and witness their suffering and roll up your sleeves and help.
Arthur Shahani, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I've read only about half your book. Mm. It was handed to me yesterday. Mm. I couldn't put it down.
I'm
going to finish it here in the next couple of days.
You're
going to be at the Central Library in downtown Kansas City tonight at 6:30. You'll be leading a discussion about that.
Excited for
They take very good care of people down there, so I think you're going to enjoy yourself.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on Up to Date.
Thank you.
Up next, Weekend Adieu.
All love, all love. I don't eat no meat, no dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. From the old school, my household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel, barbecue tofu, no fish, no candy bars, no cigarettes, only ganja.
KCUR contributor Brian McTavish is here. He follows and writes about pop culture. I don't know how he got that job. It's so much better than mine. With him, Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. They join us in the studio each week with ideas for your weekend. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Always great to be with you.
Spencer, what do we got first?
So the hip-hop duo Dead Prez does a good job of telling you what this event is all about. This is the Midwest Soul Veg Fest, okay? I want you to think eating healthier, you know, live music, heavy conversations around the environment, you know, diet and exercise, all those things will be going on at 18th and Vine this weekend, Saturday, on 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Wow. So what's the coolest thing that you can do there?
So I think one of the biggest things is, you know, there's been a real push towards vegan food, and I grew up on soul food, and so there's a growing meshing between vegan soul food. So I'm really interested to see what some of the
dishes
are.
Wait a minute, give me a vegan soul food menu option.
That's like, so there's obviously the collard greens, there's special things you can do with macaroni and cheese. Obviously it's kind of a vegan cheese. Mm. There's something you can do with sweet potatoes. They do different kind of bases with breads. So that's really what I'm trying to figure out with what's going down at this event is what are the different types of vegan soul food that you can really dig into. But that's only one component of what this is. So,
oh, and what's the other component?
So again, there's the live music. Right. Then there's the backdrop of the historic 18th and Vine District. All those things are creating kind of a really nice landscape for folks to explore on Saturday.
Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., the Vine Street Great Lawn in the 18th and Vine District.
Right here, right now, I put the offer out. I don't want to chase you down. I know you see it. You run with me, and I can cut you free out of the treachery of walls you keep in.
All right, Brian, what do we got there?
Hugh Jackman.
No, the Hugh Jackman?
Wolverine.
Oh.
Except, instead of like hearing snicked, right? Because that's the comic book-based sound effect that Wolverine makes when he extends his super sharp claws. No snickting when it comes to Hugh Jackman and his show, 7:30, Sunday night at Sprint Center. It's called The Man, The Music, The Show, and that's what you're going to get, all three elements. Of course, yes, he is Wolverine, but here, Hugh, who comes down, or comes from Australia way, I believe, right? And he's sharing songs from his starring turns in more than a few stage and movie musicals, including Les Miserables. Mm. Am I saying that right?
Close enough.
I think that's close enough. And The Greatest Showman, that was his movie musical not too long ago, along with lots of dancing and storytelling about his impressively successful while also being very diverse showbiz career. It's a 2.5-hour show. You get the Broadway, the big band, the jazz, even a little rock and roll. Sadly, no snicked.
Sounds to me like instead of Snoop Dogg, they should have had Hugh at late night at KU.
Really?
Wouldn't it be in the kind of problems that they are having?
Were there
now?
Really problems?
Well, that's what they say. That's what they say. Hugh Jackman, one man show.
Maybe Hugh will give a shout out to Snoop. You never know.
7:30 Sunday at the Sprint Center.
Been eating donuts all of our lives. Yes, we love donuts day and night.
Well, I'm going to guess I know what this is about, but give me the details, Spencer.
Absolutely. So when I first found this song, I thought that it should have won a Grammy. That aside, this is clearly about the Donut Festival. Now, for those who were tuning in last week, you remember that I had the Grilled Cheese Festival. This week, I have the Donut Festival, and spoiler alert, but not too much of a spoiler, I'll have something next weekend. You'll have to tune in next week to see what that is. But for the Donut Fest, this event is going on Sunday, 2 to 7 p.m., 134th and Holmes. You can guess what it's all about. There will be sample donuts from all across the city. There will also be different types of teas and coffees, but here's the part that really intrigued me. We often wash a donut down. Well, I usually wash it down with milk. Is that pretty standard, I would say?
Pretty standard.
They also have mimosas. They have a beer bar, and here's the new thing. They're going to have a beer mosa for you to try here. So you get donuts, you get delicious drinks, and you also get a beer mosa. So a lot to try out this Sunday, 2 to 7 p.m., 134th and Holmes.
Wait a minute, Brian. I see that you have a puzzled look on your face. Or is that just...
Pretty much all the time. But it gets you to look at me, which I love. Okay, so can you dunk in a mimosa a donut?
You know, I think that... there's going to be a ton of innovation going on. I think that's something that you can experiment with if you go. I am not going to do that. I am a Lamar's guy through and through. Give me a glazed donut and some milk, and I'm good to go. But for the more adventurous, that could be something you try out.
The glazed donut, that's how you tell if they're making good donuts.
Absolutely.
They can make a glazed, it's golden.
I just want to say that I'm still mourning the loss of John Space Age Donuts in Overland Park. Mm. But the Donut Fest, Sunday, 2 p.m. to 7 p.m., the Martin Event Space, 134 and Holmes in Kansas City, Missouri. That's down in Martin City.
Every day is not sunshine, but you can see the light if you open your eyes to the love that surrounds you. Picking up pieces of my life, sometimes there's ones I just can't find, but they found a home with you.
Brian, tell me about this very pleasant song we're listening to.
Isn't it nice? I'm going to tell you about it. That is Kat King, spelled with K's. Kat King. She'd be great to catch Saturday afternoon from noon to 6. That's noon to 6 Saturday afternoon at Porch Fest KC. It's the fifth annual event. You get 150 music acts, including Kat King, performing on 68 Midtown Kansas City neighborhood porches. Did I mention it was noon to 6 on Saturday? It is a fall tradition. They expect 5,000 or 6,000 wandering listeners to come. It will take place this year in three adjacent neighborhoods, Roanoke, Union Hill, and Longfellow. You can also hear music in historic Union Station. Plenty of food trucks. Sorry, you can't go inside the houses. You can't go beyond the front porch to use the restroom, but there should be plenty of pot-a-porties. No coolers, no pets, but you know what you should bring?
What?
Cash money, because these talented musicians need cash money. They do it for the love, but if you can give them some money, gosh, they'd appreciate it. Parking, eh. They got shuttle buses. Park as well as you can. Shuttle buses for free, though, going from all the neighborhoods.
So no Bitcoin, I'm taking it.
I'm thinking not.
Okay.
Although, just, hey, just you know what? Hey, they might have the machine. They might be able to go there.
We'll see what
might
happens.
Have the machine. Porch Fest KC, noon to 6 p.m. on Saturday. Roanoke Park, Union Cemetery, and Union Cemetery Park. Spencer, tell me what kind of fun Cyndi Lauper's having right there.
Absolutely. So with you two men on the mic guiding us through the events every week, I thought it was also important to acknowledge that sometimes we can overlook some of the wonderful events that are targeted towards our women listeners here in Kansas City. So lo and behold, we have Coding and Cocktails this Saturday, October 12, 5 to 9 p.m. And you've seen paint classes, you've seen wine classes, and now it's time to get techie and learn web development basics over trendy drinks. This is an introductory programming series for women complete with custom crafted cocktails. It's really important, and they put this all over their flyers, that no previous experience in programming is required. Just come as you are with your curiosity. This event is being put on by Kansas City Women in Technology.
Previous experience in cocktails, though, I would suspect would be good.
You know, I think for both, but I think that a lot of folks may have some previous experiences with cocktails.
Are you cocktailing and coding simultaneously?
I think it's a mix. You know, maybe the cocktails are a social lubricant to kind of get things working, and then they have classes and different sessions you can do. Make sure you're up on web development.
That sounds interesting.
Coding Absolutely. And Cocktails, Saturday, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. The Very Ship, 8880 Ward Parkway, number 300. That is in Kansas City, Missouri. Brian, it's back to you, and I'm thinking, don't dog me out here, man.
I will not. Later. Not now. Barktoberfest. It's Barktoberfest. More dogs than you can throw a stick to fetch at. 10 o'clock to 9 o'clock Saturday, 10 o'clock to 5 o'clock Sunday at Berkeley Riverfront Park. Wiener dog races. Dock dogs for Fidos to run and jump and swim, and doggy yoga and a doggy fashion show, and more than we can even get to at this time. Dogs. Do you have a dog?
I have a cat.
Good for you.
Yeah, I know. It seems to work out a lot easier.
I agree.
Barktoberfest, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday at Berkeley Riverfront Park. Gentlemen, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Yesterday on the program, some little-known LGBTQ history archived here in Kansas City. Did you know about our thriving drag scene in the 1970s? Hear about that and other historical bits of local activism at kcur.org/up-to-date. That and other conversations are at kcur.org. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. I'm at Sam Zeff. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, are the movies we watch influencing the way we live our lives? Film historian David Thompson will try to untangle the notions of masculinity, femininity, beauty, and sex that our movies are portraying. Join us for that. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Sam Zeff, and you're up to date.